any of the points I've been talking to you about. I also think you'll like it. My course is unusual, I should say radical, because it's a writing course in which no writing is required. That was the only way I could force my students not to visualize their completed article in advance, but to stop and think about all the prior decisions that have to be made about its content and its shape and its voice. My method is to ask them to select one place that's important to them that they want to write about, and to explain to the class why they want to write about it and how they want to write about it. The result is that in every class, three or four of them invite the rest of us into their lives. They describe a place that has touched their interest or their emotions, and they tell us how they intend to write about it. Which usually, as it turns out, isn't the way to write about it. As they talk, they begin to see that their approach has a lot of problems of compression and narrative line that they just haven't thought through. So we discuss those problems together, as a class, and the story begins to tell us where the real story is. I always tell my students that if they actually write their article, I'll be glad to read it, even after the class is over, but that's not my primary interest. My interest is in the process, not in the product, no matter how long the journey might take. I want to give my students a different timetable for whatever they write for the rest of their lives. I want to slow them down. Well, for one student, a lawyer in his late 30s, this is the story that I want to tell you. The journey took 3 years. One day in 1996, he called me to say that he had finally wrestled into submission the subject he had presented to the class in 1993. Would I look at it? I said, sure. What arrived was a 350-page manuscript. I'll admit that one part of me didn't want to see a 350-page manuscript, but a larger part of me was delighted that the process I had set in motion had worked its way to a conclusion. I was also curious to see how the lawyer had solved his problems, because I remembered them well. The place he wanted to write about, he told us, was the town of Westport, Connecticut, where he grew up. And his theme was soccer. Playing on the school team as a boy, he had formed close friendships with five other boys who also loved the sport, and he wanted to write about that bonding experience. Well, that was a good writer's subject, a memoir. So strong was the bond, the lawyer went on to say, that the six friends were still bonded as midlife professionals in the New York area. They still saw each other regularly. And he also wanted to write about that, and about his gratitude to soccer for providing it. That was also a good subject, a personal essay. But there was still more. He also wanted to write about the state of soccer today. He said the texture of the sport he loved has been eroded by social change. For instance, the players no longer use a locker room. They get into their uniform at home and drive to the field and then drive home again. The lawyer's idea was to volunteer as a soccer coach at his old school and to write about the contrast between the present and the past. That was still another good subject, investigative journalism. I enjoyed hearing the lawyer's story. I was being taken into a world I knew nothing about, and his affection for that world was very appealing. But I also knew he was about to drive himself crazy, and I told him so. He couldn't possibly fit all those stories under one small roof. He would have to choose one story. As it turned out, he did fit all those stories under one roof, but the house had to be greatly enlarged, and the job took him 3 years. After I read his manuscript, he asked me if it was good enough to be published. I told him it was still one rewrite away. Maybe he just didn't want to make the effort. He said that having traveled this far, he'd probably give it one more shot. Then he said, "But even if it never gets published, I'm glad I did it. I can't begin to describe how rewarding it's been to write about what soccer has meant in my life." Well, that made my day, because it confirmed a point that I feel strongly about, which, as I said earlier, is that there are many good reasons for writing, especially a memoir, that have nothing to do with getting published. Writing for yourself, for your own pleasure, or writing for your children and your grandchildren and your friends is very rewarding. There's no better way to find out who you are and who you were at a younger age, and what you remember, and what you think, and what you know, and what you still don't know, and would still like to know. Finally, and then I'll let you go write your memoir, I haven't said much about actual writing techniques. Sentence structure, choice of words, grammar, usage, voice, cadence, and other principles of writing well. All that, as I said, was on my earlier recording. But let me just sum up those principles again for you, very briefly. These are my four cardinal principles of writing well. First, clarity. That's what you owe the reader above all. If it isn't clear, you might as well not write. Second, simplicity. It's second only to clarity. There's so much verbal bloatage in the American air. The airline pilot who announces that he's currently anticipating experiencing considerable precipitation wouldn't dream of saying it may rain. That people assume that that's good English, that that's how they ought to express themselves. Just the opposite is true. The best writers, the King James Bible, Abraham Lincoln, Thoreau, E.B. White, Red Smith, write with utmost simplicity, which is their great strength. Third, economy or brevity. Short words are better than long words. Short articles and books are better than long articles and books. You must ruthlessly cut and distill. Get rid of all the clutter. Make sure every component in your writing is doing useful work. Throw everything else out. And fourth, the great intangible that underlies all the others, humanity. Be yourself. If you don't write with humanity, all the other principles won't take you very far. So, clarity, simplicity, economy, humanity. Remember those four virtues, whatever you write, whether it's a memoir or a memo. On this recording, my concern is with the larger decisions that will determine whether you'll write a good memoir or a bad memoir. I don't want to get into the details of style. Besides, writing about your own life is such a personal act that whatever style comes naturally to you is the style you should use, provided it's true to who you are, not contrived or pompous. Pomposity is the enemy. Please, no self-importance, no writing to impress the reader, no putting on literary airs. Again, humanity. Never say anything in writing that you wouldn't comfortably say in conversation. Your style is who you are. It's not something you buy at the mall and drape onto your writing. Never try to come across, especially in a memoir, as someone you're not. But there is one technical point about writing a memoir that's important. It has to do with specific detail. Memoirs take much of their strength from precise detail. All those sights and sounds and smells that you remember from your past. All those cultural artifacts that your readers also carry somewhere in their memory. Old song titles and old movies and old radio shows. Signs along the roadside and stores along Main Street, the clothes people wore and the houses they lived in, the kitchens and the front porches and the patios and backyards, the hundreds of small vivid details that enable your readers to picture what you're describing and to relate it to their own memories and their own lives. I still remember my first reading of Alfred Kazin's memoir, A Walker in the City, long ago, because the writing was so sensory. Kazin wrote much of it with his nose. Recalling his boyhood in the immigrant ghetto of Brooklyn called Brownsville, he describes what it was like on Friday afternoons when the Jews prepared for the Sabbath, when, as he says, all work is prohibited, all travel, all household duties, even to the turning on and off a light. Jewry had found its way past its tormented heart to some ancient still center of itself. I waited for the streets to go dark, Kazin writes, as other children wait for the Christmas lights. When I returned home, the warm odor of a coffee cake baking in the oven, and the sight of my mother on her hands and knees scrubbing the linoleum on the dining room floor, filled me with such tenderness that I could feel my senses reaching out to embrace every single object in our household. The great moment came at 6 when my father returned from work, his overalls smelling faintly of turpentine and shellac, white drops of silver paint still gleaming on his chin. Hanging his overcoat in the long dark hall that led into our kitchen, he would leave in one pocket a loosely folded copy of the New York World, and then everything that beckoned to me from that other hemisphere of my brain beyond the East River would start up from the smell of fresh newsprint and the sight of the Globe on the front page. It was a paper that carried special associations for me with the Brooklyn Bridge. They published The World Under the Green Dome on Park Row, overlooking the bridge. The fresh salt air of New York Harbor lingered for me in the smell of paint and damp newsprint in the hall. I felt that my father brought the outside straight into our house with each day's copy of The World. Notice how much resonance Kazin generates with all those smells. In your memoir, any kind of detail will do the job, as long as it played a formative role in the portion of your life you've chosen to write about. Sound, for instance. I already mentioned song titles. Music is enormously evocative, especially in a memoir. Here's another kind of sound from Eudora Welty's memoir, One Writer's Beginnings. In fact, this is how the book begins. In our house on North Congress Street in Jackson, Mississippi, where I was born, the oldest of three children in 1909, we grew up to the striking of clocks. There was a mission-style oak grandfather clock standing in the hall, which sent its gong-like strokes through the living room, dining room, kitchen, and pantry, and up the sounding board of the stairwell. Through the night it could find its way into our ears. Sometimes even on the sleeping porch, midnight could wake us up. My parents' bedroom had a smaller striking clock that answered it. The dining room clock was a cuckoo clock with weights on long chains, on one of which my baby brother once succeeded in suspending the cat for a moment. Welty continues with a second kind of detail, also mechanical. My father, she writes, loved all instruments that could instruct and fascinate. On top of his folded maps was a telescope with brass extensions to find the moon and the Big Dipper after supper in our front yard, and to keep appointments with eclipses. There was also a magnifying glass, a kaleidoscope, and a gyroscope kept in a black buckram box, which he would set dancing for us on a string pulled tight. He had also supplied himself with an assortment of puzzles composed of metal rings and intersecting links and keys chained together, impossible for the rest of us, however patiently shown, to take apart. He had an almost childlike love of the ingenious. Well, notice how much we learn instantly about Eudora Welty's beginnings, the kind of home she was born into, the kind of man her father was. She has rung us into her Mississippi girlhood with the chiming of clocks up and down the stairs and even out onto the sleeping porch. Because of all those clocks, Welty goes on to say, all of us in the family have been time-minded all our lives. This was good for a fiction writer, being able to learn so penetratingly, and almost first of all about chronology. Also, she says, because her father kept a barometer and was interested in the weather, I developed a strong meteorological sensibility. When I later wrote stories, atmosphere took its influential role from the start. Commotion in the weather and the inner feelings aroused by such a hovering disturbance emerged connected in dramatic form. Look at how much richness we get from all that specific detail. Not just the detail itself, the objects with all their resonance. It's also a window into how Eudora Welty was shaped as a fiction writer at an early age by her father's obsession with gadgets. That's priceless information for any literary scholar or any writing student, anyone who wants to know how writers get formed. Welty has used memoir for exactly what it's supposed to be used for, to tell us things we want to know about her life, in this case her childhood, and about her art. Another writer who understands that many small details can add up to one big truth is Ian Fraser. I'm thinking especially of his memoir called Family. Fraser is a perfect example of all the memoir writers, you may be one of them, who inherit a vast hoard of family papers and mementos, and then have to figure out how to weave them all out and shape them into a coherent story, because nobody else in the family wants to do it. Fraser's parents died within a year of each other, leaving an apartment in Ohio in which nothing had been thrown away for several generations, and that's where he started on his memoir. Objects suggest narrative, Fraser says. That's terrific advice for anyone writing a memoir. Objects suggests a narrative. Listen to this description of how he used objects to organize his task. "I started going through my parents' papers and objects," Ian Fraser writes, "dividing them up. I made a box labeled the Mom Museum and another one called the Dad Museum, in which I put all kinds of things pertaining to my parents. Things that were evocative of them, like my dad's ties. He bought his ties in 1945 and could never see the point of changing them. Ties in 1945 were practically rectangular and about 11 inches long. Ties got thin, ties got fat, ties got thin again, ties got short, and he just wore the same ties from 1945 on. So I have those ties, and many other things. My dad was a chemist, so I have beakers and safety glasses. My dad would hardly open a can without putting on safety glasses, so I have his various safety glasses. My mother never threw away a purse. I have the history of purses back to 1942, in sequence. I took all these things," Fraser says, "and went through them like a paleontologist, inferring a culture or a species from a fragment of bone. I wanted to take my parents' lives as a piece to infer the culture they came from and its plot. My method was to look for objects that suggested narrative. If you're going through letters, for example, the first thing you do is to put them in chronological order. That's your plot right there. In some cases, I was really lucky. With my grandmother, I had letters she wrote in 1939, when my mother first went away to school, and I had the last letter she wrote in her life in 1965. I had the entire body. I could see the plot of what happened to her. I had things like the programs of the plays my mother was in as a girl. I could tell what every production meant to her, because the programs had connections to other subjects in my Mom Museum, like congratulatory telegrams. My mother saved them all. The question that you ask when you find these items, Fraser says, is what story does this object tell? To answer it, he says he often had to leave the actual objects and go to the public library, or to the place where the events happened. To understand what you have in the way of ephemera, he says, you have to be willing to do a whole bunch of different things to invest them with meaning. Well, as it turned out, Fraser did do a whole bunch of different things, so many that he spent 2.5 years of research on his memoir and another 2.5 years writing it. What he began to realize was that he could only give meaning to his parents' lives by placing them in the context of the 100-year decline of the Protestant establishment and its values. That gave him a second plot, intertwined with the first plot, and deflected him down many overgrown trails of 19th-century American social history. It's like building a house, Fraser says. You get to a certain point and you realize that you need a different gauge of lumber or something, and you have to go get it. I've told you about these two very different books, by Eudora Welty and Ian Fraser, to remind you that every memoir finally has its own unique subject and shape and length. Welty's One Writer's Beginnings is one of the shortest memoirs I know, a 112-page paperback, but it's exactly as long as it needs to be. Fraser is a more spacious writer, with a historical turn of mind. You may know his earlier book about the American West, Great Plains, and he obviously just couldn't help himself. Setting out in search of his own life and the life of his parents, he ended up going in search of entire religious movements in the Midwest that resulted in his parents being who they were and his being who he is. This may happen to you with your memoir. You may find yourself caught up in a more extensive journey than you had in mind. But I really hope it doesn't happen to you. Writing projects that get too big can wear you down. Please remember to think small. Focus on one period in your past and tell that story within strict unities of time and place and point of view. If along the way you're reminded of other stories you want to tell, save them for another memoir. Leave the big picture to Marcel Proust. He wrote the ultimate memoir, Remembrance of Things Past, 7 volumes long. He holds the world record for specific detail, not likely to be broken. Actually, I like Proust's own French title better, In Search of Lost Time. That's the search that haunts us all, especially as we get older. Where did the time go? And that's the search I hope you'll embark on. Go in search of the lost time in your own life and in the life of your family, and get it written down so it won't stay lost. You'll be glad you did, and I know you're going to enjoy it. But before you go, here's a P.S. On this recording, I mentioned or read from a lot of good memoirs, and I thought it might be helpful to you if I repeated those titles here so you don't have to go back and hunt for them. I'll give them to you in the order I mentioned them on the recording. Angela's Ashes by Frank McCourt. Growing Up by Russell Baker. The Road from Corain, C-O-O-R-A-I-N, by Jill Kerr Conway. Speak Memory by Vladimir Nabokov, N-A-B-O-K-O-V. Fierce Attachments by Vivian Gornick, G-O-R-N-I-C-K. A Cab at the Door by V.S. Pritchett. Operating Instructions by Anne Lamott, L-A-M-O-T-T. Naples 44 by Norman Lewis, L-E-W-I-S. A Drinking Life by Pete Hamill, H-A-M-I-L-L. The Liars Club by Mary Carr, K-A-R-R. This Boy's Life by Tobias Wolff, W-O-L-F-F. Five Boyhoods by Howard Lindsay, Harry Golden, Walt Kelly, John Updike, and William Zinsser. That one's long out of print, but it's probably in the public library. An American Childhood by Annie Dillard. Out of Egypt by Andre Aciman, A-C-I-M-A-N. The Woman Warrior by Maxine Hong Kingston. Ornament and Silence by Kennedy Fraser, F-R-A-S-E-R. Virgin Time, In Search of the Contemplative Life by Patricia Hampel, H-A-M-P-L. Poets in Their Youth by Eileen Simpson. Colored People by Henry Louis Gates, Jr. A Walker in the City by Alfred Kazin, K-A-Z-I-N. One Writer's Beginnings by Eudora Welty. Family by Ian Fraser, F-R-A-Z-I-E-R. Remembrance of Things Past by Marcel Proust. The passages that I read by Russell Baker, Annie Dillard, Eileen Simpson, Henry Louis Gates, Jr., and Ian Fraser are all from a book that I edited called Inventing the Truth, The Art and Craft of Memoir, in which nine writers, the other four are Frank McCourt, Alfred Kazin, Jill Kerr Conway, and Toni Morrison, talk about how they wrote, and as you heard, often rewrote, their memoirs. All writing is learned by imitation. We all need models. I learned to write by reading the people who were doing the kind of writing I wanted to do, and trying to figure out how they did it. If you read some of these memoirs, the ones that are closest to your interests, you'll get their rhythms and their methods into your ear, and you won't feel quite so alone as you set out on your own memoir.
We hope you've enjoyed this program from Harper Audio.
Audible hopes you have enjoyed this program.